Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 20. 15th hole. The pole on which perched the running totals for both of the final two golfers now showed a reversed position. Patterson was now 9 under par, and Hanover was 8 under. Scott looked at his name in the number 2 position and shook it off. No matter what happened, he was going to have his best round ever. It would be a day that would last the rest of his life. Andrew was called to the tee first. He seemed more confident, if that was possible. He was almost smiling. His silly cap with the pom-pom on top was jauntily tilted to one side. He stood in the tee box like he was a model for some golf apparel catalog's closeout section. Andrew knew he couldn't count on a birdie for this hole, a 450-yard par 4. The pin placement almost guaranteed a 2-putt, as it sat at the lower level of a split-level green. What this meant was that if he hit the ball hard enough to get near the pin, the drop-off between the two levels would send the ball rolling far past it. If he left it short of the drop-off, the first putt would also zip past the pin. It was perhaps the most difficult green on the course, particularly with this pin placement. A bogey wasn't out of the question, and he was prepared for that. However, he was confident that Hanover would find the hole difficult, if not impossible, to par. Andrew placed his ball on the tee and hefted his driver. There was a slight bend in the fairway to the right. Time for a fade. He would hit the ball with a little spin to let it follow the fairway to the right. To the left was an open area that connected to the fairway on 14. There was a hill there where an old bunker had once occupied space, but it had grown in, and the side of the hill was overgrown with tall weeds. He blasted his ball from the tee, and it sailed down the fairway, taking its expected bend, landing 260 yards from the tee. The audience applauded, and he withdrew to the back of the tee. Scott walked up. He found Sarah and blew her a kiss. She returned it. Did she care if he won? He didn't think so. He was so glad she was here. Yes, he'd be giving up his golf for a while, he had promised, but the experience of being a father, he was sure, would make up for it. Not being in the lead position, he felt no small degree of relief. Scott really hadn't noticed how much pressure he was feeling until it was gone. He placed his ball down. The fairway was pretty wide open, and the bend to the right would play well if his ball happened to slice. He took 2 practice swings, then stepped up to hit the ball. The yellow duck with its orange beak and beady black eyes was looking out towards the fairway, ready to fly. He stepped back, drew back his club, and knew as soon as the club hit the ball that he had nailed it perfectly. The ball soared straight out. It hit the fairway just behind Patterson's ball and to the left. The slight slice he had anticipated wasn't there, and the ball cut across the fairway with a couple of more bounces. A sand trap lay ahead, and as the ball continued to roll, it fell over the lip of the trap with a little speed and disappeared from view. A line of trees edged the trap and prevented spectators from lining that portion of the fairway. A few people quickly scurried over to look at where Scott's ball had landed. Pretty soon, one guy was waving a hat and pointing to the ground. He was standing almost parallel to the 150-yard marker. 300 yards in one hit. But in the sand trap. "You got a hold of that one," Paul said, praising him. "Unfortunately, it went where I aimed. Hitting off the sand should be no harder than hitting off the rough, Scott. You can still be on the green in two." "Let's hope I have a good lie." "Stop that pessimism, Scott. Good thoughts." "Good thoughts," Scott repeated. He handed Paul the driver. As they walked down the fairway, the crowd oozed along behind them until they were all in position to watch Patterson hit his second shot. Andrew was still smiling. Hanover was going to make this easy. The guy was on the wrong side of the fairway for this green, and in the sand to boot. All Andrew had to do was land on the green, and he'd be able to two-putt his way to a par. Eric handed Andrew the 5-iron. He always planned on leaving the ball on the right side of the top tier. From there, he'd have a lot of green to use for his first putt, and would likely be able to get the ball within 2 yards of the hole on the lower tier for a relatively easy second shot. He walked up to his ball and eyed a spot in front of the green where he wanted it to land. He placed his club behind the ball and shuffled his weight to get his stance perfect. He had long ago learned that if he was positioned correctly, he could predict the ball's path within a couple of yards. He struck the ball with the grace of a professional golfer. A small piece of turf followed the ball into the air. The ball landed right where he had anticipated, rolled onto the green, and stopped on the right side, about 1 yard from the slope down to the second tier. Perfect, he thought. Ellie explained to Jason about the tricky two-tiered green, and after a few questions, he felt he had the basics to comment intelligently on the situation. "It looks like Andrew Patterson has found the one spot on the green that keeps him out of too much trouble. Another yard and the slope would have carried him off the green. A little shorter, and he would have a tough time getting close to the pin on his first putt. The left side of the green presents the biggest challenge," Jason continued. "It is almost impossible to get your speed right, hitting right at the pin. Too little and you're left at the top of the slope. Too much and you roll right over the hole. Andrew Patterson knows what he's doing. Let's see how Scott Hanover does with his second shot. It's never easy to hit out of the sand." Scott and Paul walked to where the crowd of onlookers, along with a couple of red-jacketed officials, had gathered. There was a collection of glum faces, and Scott could immediately see why. The ball was sitting in a hole made by another golfer's shoe print. The lie was nearly impossible. What's more, there was a slight lip on the side of the bunker nearest the fairway. It couldn't be more difficult. In order to get the ball out, he'd need to use a sand wedge, and if he was lucky, he might knock the ball 30 or 40 yards closer to the hole. A great drive wasted. Patterson had walked over to examine Scott's predicament. He nodded his head in false sympathy, shrugged, and walked away. Scott looked up, and the large, red-jacketed man who had chewed away the bee on 13 was looking down at him. He held a bag of ice to the back of his left hand and had a frown on his face. "Can I take relief from the footprint?" Scott asked. He shook his head. "Play it as it lies. Sorry, that's the rule." Scott took his sand wedge and walked into the trap. He wouldn't have the benefit of any practice swings in the hazard. "Whack the heck out of it, Scott," Paul advised. Scott hovered the sand wedge as close to the sand as he dared without touching it. He drew the club back like he was going to clobber the ball 100 yards. His goal was to get far enough under the ball to lift it and the sand around it out of the trap, and out as far onto the fairway as he could. He prayed it was enough. He swung ferociously into the trap. The splash of sand obscured his vision as some of it fell back in his face. The hush from the crowd told him the whole story without having to look. He blinked the gritty particles out of his eyes and wiped his face with his sleeve. Sitting 2 yards closer to the hole, but still in the trap, was the ball. While he was no longer submerged in the sand, it was very near the lip at the edge of the trap. A good shot would get him out of the sand, but maybe only a few yards closer to the hole. He walked up to where the ball rested. He readied himself quickly, trying to gauge his stroke based on the swing he just made. Even if he got out now, he was still 2 strokes minimum from getting in the hole. Patterson would pick up at least 1 stroke, and without a miracle putt from Scott, likely 2. He tried to banish the thought from his head. He let his club hover over the sand again and prepared to blast the ball and a little bit of sand under it as far as he could. His club sank deep into the sand, and as the ball took off, it bounced against the edge of the sand trap and rebounded backwards, 1 yard behind where he had just hit it. A tough lie in the sand after his drive, and now, 2 strokes later, he still finds himself in the same trap. "This has got to be eating Hanover up inside," Jason Bernard said. The video screen replayed the first shot in slow motion, the spray of sand almost obliterating everything. Assuming Hanover can get it out in 1 more try, Andrew Patterson will pick up possibly 3 more strokes on this hole and take a 4-stroke lead. Perhaps too much for Scott Hanover to reclaim in the remaining 3 holes of this tournament, considering the consistency that Patterson has been showing. The camera framed a live shot of Scott. He was wiping his eyes again and looked back at the ball. His face twisted into an expression of confusion. He walked to where the ball had landed and looked at it with utter despair. He took a quick look around the sand trap and then stepped out to consult with his caddy. "A little confusion in the sand trap on 15, Jason commented. "What's the matter?" asked Paul, as Scott's look of confusion persisted. He almost whispered back, "That's not my ball." "What? There's no duck. It's a Nike ball. There's just that little swish and a number 1 on it. Oh man, I've really screwed up now." Paul listened to what Scott said, walked over to the ball, and as he turned around, he was smiling. "It's not your ball." "What?" Andrew Patterson asked from nearby. "Then whose is it?" "The ball was buried in the sand. I couldn't see the duck, but everyone was pointing at it like it was my ball." He glanced around, scanning the area behind the trap, and there, lying next to a sandrake, just outside the hazard, was his ball, neatly perched on the grass. It had rolled clear across the sand trap, and the rake had neatly hidden the ball from a casual glance. It was easy to assume the ball in the sand was his. He picked up the rake and pointed at the ball. "This is mine." "Then he gets some sort of penalty, right?" Andrew asked the red-jacketed man with the ice pack on his hand. "Well, there would be a 2-stroke penalty for playing the wrong ball." "I knew it," Patterson said. Scott cringed at the thought. He quickly calculated the damages. 5 strokes more for Patterson's lead. "I hadn't finished," continued the large man. "However, since the strokes were taken while the wrong ball was in a hazard, there is no penalty."
"You mean I just play my original ball?" Scott asked.
"That's right. The last 2 strokes won't count."
"That can't be right," Patterson said, demanding an explanation. The man pulled out his pocket edition of the Rules of Golf and handed them to Andrew.
"Look it up for yourself. Page 41. Mr. Hanover is still lying 1, ready to hit his 2nd stroke.
Andrew quickly flipped through the book and his eyes scanned the bottom of the page. He looked up, shaking his head in disbelief.
"You lucky," he muttered.
He threw the book back at the official and stomped off across the fairway.
"Hey," Paul said, "those Nike balls are good. Toss it here."
Scott tossed the ball to his caddy. Paul pocketed it and pulled an 8-iron from the bag.
"This'll get you on, Scott," he said.
Scott walked to the far side of the hazard. The ball was sitting on the grass like it was on a tee. He took 2 practice swings, then stepped up to his ball. The duck was once again facing the pin, laughing at him this time.
"Nice joke," Scott said. "Now get on that green."
He swung at the ball, and it floated up and onto the front fringe of the green. It continued to roll and looked like it was going to disappear over the slope and roll off the green, but it stopped, perched just on the edge.
"Nice shot," complimented Paul.
"You can't be good," Paul completed the saying.
"Be lucky."
"What happened?" Sarah asked. "He must have hit that ball 3 or 4 times."
"I don't know," Sally said.
She turned to the red-jacketed woman who was their escort.
"Do you know what is going on?"
"I really couldn't tell you."
"He was playing the wrong ball," a man said from behind them.
Sarah turned towards a man in a shiny blue satin Cubs jacket who was holding an iPhone in his hand, a cord running to an earplug.
"What does that mean?"
Sarah asked.
"Normally it would be a penalty, but since he was in the sand trap, he can just forget he played those other shots and play his original ball."
"How did he play the wrong ball?" Gina asked him.
"Some idiot left a ball in the trap, and the first people there saw it, and nobody checked. His actual shot rolled right out of the back of the sand trap."
"Thank you," Sarah said. "Good thing he didn't have to keep those shots."
"Oh, yeah," the Cubs fan said. "That Patterson guy seemed really pissed about it."
"Good," Sarah said with satisfaction.
It was God's way of making up for the flubbed shot on the last hole, she thought. If God cared about things like that.
What appeared to be a windfall for Andrew Patterson has now resulted in both golfers sitting on the green after 2 strokes, Lucy Pendle reported. Things certainly could have been much worse. If Hanover had hit the wrong ball after it left the trap, there would have been an automatic 2-stroke penalty. If he had finished the hole with the wrong ball and started the next one, he would have been disqualified if the mistake had been discovered. It seemed apparent at first that Scott Hanover didn't realize he wouldn't be penalized for his mistake, and the look of horror on his face was heartbreaking. However, the new lease on the hole should give his confidence a boost. I can't wait to see how this plays out. Back to you, Jason.
Thanks, Lucy. Well, we're learning something new about this game with every hole. Back with the putts after this.
Andrew Patterson was the furthest from the hole. He had the slope to contend with. He just needed to get the ball to the next tier within 2 yards of the hole. Fortunately, where he was on the right side of the green, the difference between the levels was less than where Hanover was perched. There was also a little break to the left that he could use. He wouldn't be able to hit straight at the pin, but if he got the distance right, he shouldn't be more than 2 yards away. He lined up his putt and tapped the ball fairly lightly. It rolled down the slope, picking up speed, and caught the break, which diverted the ball from spilling off the back of the green. His speed was perfect, and the ball stopped 1 yard to the right of the hole. The crowd applauded his accomplishment of this difficult shot. He was more than satisfied. From there, he had a straight shot into the hole. Andrew walked up to where his ball was and looked at Hanover's lie. The ball was perched on the rim of the slope no more than 2 yards from the hole, but the steepness of the slope would make it impossible for the ball not to continue to roll right off the green. From there, he would likely end up with 2 more shots to get it in. Andrew figured he could count on picking up 1 more stroke here, lengthening his lead to 2. He marked his ball and stepped back off the green in a line between the hole and his golden dollar marker. Scott and Paul stared at the ball.
"Another inch," said Paul, "and you'd be off the back of the green."
"I still may be," added Scott. "Any way I can get some backspin on this ball?"
Paul laughed at the suggestion. Just hit it as lightly as you can and aim straight for the hole. It'll just roll over it like the hole isn't there, Scott pointed out. It might and it might not. You saw Patterson's ball. This green is a little slower than you think. Just nudge it and hope it slows enough on the flat that you aimed perfectly. That's the key, agreed Scott. I have to be right at the hole. Here's what you do, Paul said, and he gave Scott his suggestion. Really? Scott asked. Hey, be the ball. You know, I've got nothing to lose. Scott let out a deep breath and searched for Sarah. She stood directly in back of the hole and had her fingers crossed on both hands. He looked at the ball and laid the putter behind it. No practice strokes here. They wouldn't make a difference. He stared at the putter and ball, then twisted his head to see the hole, then returned his gaze to the ball. He made a fine adjustment in the putter and checked again, readjusting a little back. A third check confirmed he was as perfect as he could be. He closed his eyes and relaxed his grip on the club a little. Then he lifted his head, his lids still shut. There was a sudden hush over the crowd, and this time the silence didn't bother him. He was no longer on the putting green of the 15th hole of George Dunn National Golf Course. He was no longer holding a golf club in his hand, and there was no ball waiting to be hit. He was staring out his bedroom window, watching the beauty of the sunrise he had seen earlier that day. Sarah was behind him, holding him, reassuring him, loving him. She had her arms wrapped around him and her body next to his. It was almost like she was guiding his putt. He didn't remember hitting the ball, but with his eyes still closed, he heard a chorus of people chanting, "Yes, yes, yes," louder and louder, and a thunk, followed by thunderous applause. Paul's heavy hand on his back snapped him out of his daydream, and his eyes opened wide. He turned to look at the hole, but all he saw was Sarah, clapping and jumping and screaming. "Yes, yes!" "It went in?" he had to ask. "Scott, it was amazing!" "It had to be. Where the heck were you? It was like you were possessed." "I think I was, Paul. I think Sarah just sank that putt." "What?" "I wasn't here. She was holding me, guiding me." "Hey, whatever it takes. Look over at Patterson." Andrew Patterson's mouth hung open, his putter leaning loosely at his side. His head slowly shook from side to side with disbelief. "That look is worth it," Scott said. "Yeah, ain't it pretty?" Paul agreed. Jake Fisher was clapping as loud as anyone else. He watched Scott and Paul conversing loudly on the green. That shot was one in a million. Maybe not as impressive as a hole in one, but if he had hit the ball any harder, it wouldn't have gone in. The scariest part was when Scott lifted his head up with his eyes closed. He was smiling bigger than a Cheshire cat and seemed willing to put the putt in God's hand. The club's movement was almost imperceptible, and the ball barely moved, but it was enough. And the slope pulled it down. It picked up speed quickly, but from the first moment, one could tell it was headed straight for the hole. Too much speed and it would roll right over it and off the green. The ball did skip over the hole, but managed to catch the back rim of the cup, then dropped in with determination. Scott and Patterson would be tied now, assuming Patterson made his putt. 5 minutes ago, Scott was going to be 4 strokes behind. Now he was tied. Jake felt for the contract in his jacket pocket, realizing that Hanover might just be able to do it. There was hope here. Scott could win. Patterson walked slowly to his ball marker. The crowd was still wild with excitement for Hanover's putt. He placed the ball down and picked up the coin. He had to wait maybe 10 seconds before things quieted down enough for him to putt. With precision, he knocked a 3-foot shot into the hole. The applause was a fraction of Hanover's, but still polite. He couldn't help but think that most of these people had gotten a certain pleasure out of seeing Hanover make that impossible putt. If only Hanover hadn't noticed he had the wrong ball, this would be over. But there were still 3 holes. Andrew would come back.
"Well," started Jason Barnard, "I don't think many people have seen a putt like that. Everyone here was saying the slope was too great for the ball to go in. But apparently nobody told Scott Hanover that. And with his eyes closed, I don't think I'll ever see anything as amazing as that again. At least not today."
Around the country, millions of heads nodded in agreement. This guy was hot, and there was going to be no stopping him. A day earlier, Scott Hanover had been no one of consequence. Today, he was working his way into a permanent spot of American golf lore.
"At 9 strokes under par, he and Patterson are not only tied on the course, but tied for a tournament record. He'd have to shave off another 4 strokes off par to tie the professional golfing record for 18 holes, but his bogey on 14 helped to eliminate those hopes. But no matter what, we're getting a great show today."
There were a couple of dozen people already crowded around the 16th green when Karen, April, and Tim Carousel finally trudged around the trees. There were even spectators waiting on the 18th green. Several huddled around a tiny smartphone, screaming and shouting and jumping.
"What is all that about?" Carousel asked.
"We'll soon find out," April said. She pointed to the tee, and 2 golfers, surrounded by 100 people, emerged from a space between the trees. "We'll be able to watch the last 3 holes live as they happen."
Carousel slammed his palm on the back of his neck. "I think something just bit me."
"Let me see," Karen said. She looked and only saw the bright red palm print. "No, nothing there, just an itch."
"Perhaps," he muttered, waving away a few gnats from around his face. "Probably would have been better off in the clubhouse."
He looked around and sighed.
"But we're here now. Nothing to do for it at this point."
Karen shook her head as she looked at April, who was just as frustrated with Carousel. Still, they intended to get the most they could from his presence, and him offering Patterson a contract with Callaway on live television could only help their client down the road. Keith Kelly found the storage shed behind the clubhouse. The large sliding garage door was open, and inside was a golf cart with a trailer attached. In the trailer was a dripping wetsuit, air tank, and mask, along with a snorkel.
"Can I help you?" interrupted a voice.
Keith turned and saw a man in coveralls holding a wrench.
"Looks like somebody was doing some diving today," he observed.
"Yep, that was me. I think I made Kenny Chase's day."
"Who's Kenny Chase?"
"He's with the Golf Association. He needed a certain ball from a water trap. To tell you the truth, I didn't think there was a chance I'd ever find it. Probably wouldn't have if it weren't for the duck."
"The duck?"
"Printed on the ball. A rubber ducky. You know, Ernie's rubber ducky from Sesame Street."
"Why did he want it?" Keith asked.
He often found that the more he acted ignorant of something, the more people wanted to explain. He was sure that the tournament wanted Hanover's ball for testing. But he couldn't just ask this guy to tell him where the ball was now. He'd get too suspicious and clam up. But if he let him talk, it would all come out.
"Didn't tell me straight out, mind you, but I'm betting that Hanover fellow was using illegal balls. I didn't have any other logo than the duck picture. Mighty suspicious, if you ask me."
"Wow," Keith said with an appropriate amount of awe.
That could get him disqualified, couldn't it?
"Wouldn't be the first time a player broke the rules."
"Well, I'm sure this Mr. Chase will settle the matter," Keith said.
"Probably already has."
"What?"
"I saw him come back a few minutes ago.
He had taken the ball to have some tests done or something. Don't know exactly what he could get done on a Saturday, but he used to test balls for the PGA. He knows his stuff."
"I think I saw him.
Short guy with gray hair and pot belly?" he asked.
"Nah," corrected the driver. "Chase is tall, blonde hair, thin, wearing a red jacket. He was getting some coffee last I saw him.
My mistake, apologized Keith, as he tried to suppress his smile. Well, I better get back to the clubhouse. I don't want to get into any trouble. No trouble at all.
Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you're interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries about a Crime-Solving Veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.